I'm going to talk about, from an advocacy perspective, growing healthy communities. And I think, thank you, I think what we've heard from the speakers is how exciting it can get when things start to snowball and when you get these interventions at multiple levels and multiple sectors that suddenly start feeding on each other in a positive way rather than a negative way. And I want to build on that a little bit. I work at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis, and we work both at a policy and practice level to ensure fair, healthy, and sustainable food systems for everyone. I just want to point out that we're talking a lot about food systems, but to remind ourselves of what systems are, and that there's this emerging literature around systems thinking for these complex public health issues. And often it's the connections, like we saw with the gardening, the connections that are sometimes intangible between things and systems that might be the most important or at least a critical element of these systems. And yet they're very hard to measure with our current tools. And the other thing about connections is that, as I said, in a positive food system, they can be self-reinforcing, but they can also be reinforcing in a negative or dysfunctional food system. And that creates a lot of inertia, particularly because these issues can be very political and can reflect differences in power between different agents in the food system. So policies, as we heard, are important because they often set the default conditions in these systems. So in other words, it's the set point in the system. And so it can be very hard to change that set point unless you change the underlying policies. And that's why I'm talking about advocacy. And of course, we all as health professionals shouldn't underestimate our importance as agents of change within our communities. So just a reminder, maybe we're not all fortunate enough to live in places like Denver or Colorado that have all these resources. Maybe we're in different localities. Maybe we're thinking more regionally about how to change food systems, or even globally, because the reality is that our industrialized food system more and more is dominated by these huge entities that literally work from the local level up to the global level. And I think we're in danger unless we integrate our conception of food systems at all of those levels to have some of our local work undercut by the policies setting the default conditions at a national or even an international level. And so I want to just take a few minutes and talk about some of the ways you can work at policy at the national as well as the local level. I'm going to talk a little bit about farm policy because that's obviously set more at a national level than at a local level. And that does some important things. For one thing, it sets the research agenda for what kind of a future food system we're going to have. And so the food system we have right now is in large part a reflection of decades worth of a research agenda that was really about producing in an industrial way a lot of commodity crops, super efficient meat production at a large scale, not so much about fruits and vegetables. So if we want to turn that around, we got to think proactively about a new research agenda. The fact of that there's this crazy price disparity, so that the least healthy foods are actually the most affordable, okay, in many cases. Some of these things are influenced at the national level. I'm going to skip that. So, tools for change. Let's just run through some of these. I heard a presentation yesterday about this IOM report, which you should look at. And it lays out, if you haven't seen it, specific strategies that I think are great and action steps. I think 9 of these are on healthy eating, others are on active living. So this is an effective tool for an advocate to go to a city planner, to go to an elected official, and say, look, this basically has the imprimatur of the Institute of Medicine. There are a couple of places that are places where you can go to find examples of policies, either state or local policies, that have been enacted in other places. So the Rudd Center has collected all these in a fantastic resource. But so has the Denver-based National Conference of State Legislatures. So you can search by state, you can search by topic, and it has this wealth of information, which I think is evolving constantly. Partnerships. We've heard some of the fantastic partnerships that LiveWell and others have put together here. How do you find partners? You know, what if you're really intensely interested in this work, but you don't know where to start or who to talk to? Or, you know, one place to go is farmtoschool.org. And if you search on your state, it starts to tell you about some of the groups that are already involved. So, you know, here's my group at the top in Minnesota, and a number of others as well. But this is a way for people to find each other. Well, nationally, I think things really change quite a bit, as someone else alluded to, with the launch of the Let's Move initiative. And this did really kind of put on the national spotlight the idea of community and school change. Those are two of the four pillars of the Let's Move initiative: changing school food environments and activity environments, and changing community environments. And there's some great resources that they've put together, including for researchers, trying to develop indicators. And I think these two could be enormously useful, even at the local level, for giving a visual representation of some of the problems and what you might want to do about them. But one of the things that the Let's Move initiative isn't really looking at, but that I think is incredibly important, is these farm policies. And we're entering a phase now where we're moving into another farm bill cycle. The farm bill is this huge omnibus bill. It's about $300 billion every 5 years. It's very political. And in the past, public health has not really been a very active player. A little bit around the nutrition title, which is a major part of the farm bill. It's kind of a misnomer. It really ought to be the food bill, as you probably heard. And so one of the things that my organization's doing is trying to create a broad, like the broadest possible community of health professionals of all stripes to act as a voice for this future food system that's going to be good from the farm to the fork. So healthy for farming, healthy for the food system. And so with that, I'm just going to stop and invite you to join the network and also hear your questions. So thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. Yes.
Well, we're doing a number of things. First of all, we've launched a Healthy Food, Healthy Farm webinar series. So for example, we've done a webinar on the use of antibiotics in livestock production and how that impacts public health. We're doing a webinar in December to focus on this issue of whether SNAP vouchers should be limited in terms of their use on soda, so to get different perspectives on that issue. It's to try to create a conversational venue, you know, across health disciplines, because it's great that we've got such huge interest at APHA, but what about the American Psychological Association? What about the AMA? What about the nurses? So hopefully this is a way to get people across our health silos involved in a conversation with each other.
Then are you planning to take
Yes, we're identifying specific policy issues that could use a more effective health voice and giving people, you know, we're all busy, right? And clinicians in particular, you know, are terribly busy, so it's going to make it really easy to just click if you're signed up to the network and be able to send a letter to the FDA or, you know, sign on to a petition to Secretary Vilsack or, you know, send a letter to the White House. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so this is where we wanted to try to understand how they related to fruit and vegetable consumption. So this allowed us to look at people's involvement in social activities. So we scored based on 5 items. We came up with a score for all our participants. And so that was the variable we used. We had neighborhood attachment. It wasn't included in this model, but that looked at people's emotional connection to place. How attached are they to their neighborhoods? And then the other sort of psychological component was aesthetics, so sense of beauty. And that was also a series of items where we scored it, came up with a score for each respondent, and that became our variable. And that's what we put into that middle model, just to look at that relationship with fruit and vegetable consumption. Just to give us a sense, does it matter? And it does. And then based on the cross-section of information that we had, and then we rolled in the community garden piece of it.
Yes. I want to thank you all for an excellent presentation. Excellent, inspiring. An epidemiologist who's also a community gardener, I've got a question about your variable called perception of neighborhood aesthetics. How did you measure that? And I see some kind of relationship to one of the important data points that you brought out, that 88% live in a community, want to see a gardener, whether they are gardeners or not. Can you tell me more about the neighborhood aesthetic perception?
Yeah, so these were questions like, there are beautiful buildings in my neighborhood, there are lots of trees in my neighborhood, there are beautiful natural sites in my neighborhood. It got at more things within the perceptible realm of people's everyday life. So it wasn't a measure of percent green space in a neighborhood. In fact, we saw inverse relationships with that. The more green space you had, the lower scores you had on all our social and psychological variables. So again, quantity, we know this. Quantity doesn't matter as much as quality. And the aesthetics piece got at this other realm of everyday life, what you look at when you're on your porch, what you look at when you're walking your dog, and so forth. So it was a really interesting measure. It's been so significant in the literature, but not really talked about. So it's kind of in the papers for physical activity, but there's no discussion about it. Like, what does that mean? Attractiveness. But it really is a big factor in why people are active or not. It's the same for fruit and vegetable consumption. It was the same for BMI, and that's a paper we haven't published. So it's just a really powerful measure based on the data that we looked at.
We actually find people come down to look at our and spend some time walking through the various plots and talking to the community gardeners, whether or not they ever actually ask for a piece of it. We kind of move to the neighborhood environment.
Thank you.
So yeah, that's one of the disparities of gardens, right? That schools are in session when you're planting and when maybe you're harvesting. And there's all this work that goes on in the summertime, especially in this climate. So again, the story comes from within some of our school communities in which kids were saying, we're involved with the garden, learning about it, being in it during the during the spring season. And can we? Is there anything we can do to stay in this garden in the summertime? And so we developed some of our summer programming, our youth farmers markets, based on kids' desires to stay involved in the garden. And the Connecting Generations program that Jill talked about, where we're connecting neighborhood adults with and gardeners with the kids, the summer piece is critical. We found that those mentors are helping teachers in classrooms to utilize the garden as best possible to teach kids and use it as a place for discovery. But also, they're there to help take over in the summertime when kids still want to be involved in the garden. They still want to come to the garden. We run programs that are entrepreneurial based in a lot of ways, where kids are growing but also learning to sell the produce within their community. One of our oldest youth farmers markets has kids coming back every year now to mentor younger kids. And then ultimately, after a good, close to a decade in that community, doing a youth farmers market, being in the school, having the garden become the centerpiece of that community, we found out this last year that families are starting to grow their own gardens in their backyards, because kids are making this part of the lifestyle of the family. So it's a tricky issue in that off-season piece, but we're finding that folks are more than happy to stay connected to the garden and as parents and with their kids.
I think we have time for one last question.
This is one for Dr. King. This is a fascinating session, so rich. But I'm wondering, when we put all of these elements together, you gave a set of questions when you began, and then you gave some conclusions when you ended. But you've been able to look at Colorado. But the recommendations for evidence-based interventions and so forth are being implemented throughout the country. And so what do you have any sense about if we're going to reach a tipping point? What are the upstream, midstream, and, say, outcome measures that we ought to be looking for and setting reasonable expectations for the funders, who all, of course, want to claim that their work that caused the change, and to have some, I guess, reasonable expectations beyond obesity and beyond
Thank you for your question. That is a great question that we've been asking ourselves, because we spent a lot of time researching the reasons everybody's getting heavier and why obesity, and a lot of energy and research dollars and evidence on what we think got us here. And now the questions have changed. And the questions now are, well, you're implementing all these things. Is anybody losing weight? Is anybody eating differently? Is anyone exercising more? And so David had referenced the IOM report, and that really looks at, and the CDC has a similar set of recommendations, looks at some of these intermediate outcomes that could be measures. And so they're looking at things like, do all residents have a grocery store within a 1 mile distance of their home? If they don't, you know, what other things are around where they can purchase those foods? On the physical activity side, are people, you know, what is the street mileage of sort of walkable infrastructure relative to non-walkable, or distance from parks or recreation? So they're really looking at the things that could be fairly easy to track, because you can see it and you can map it as intermediate, to measure the behavior change. We really need to, and this is what we're starting to realize, probably start to follow cohorts of individuals and do some observational or survey kind of measures at individuals, because when we continue to measure at the population level, it's different people that you're asking every year, and it takes, as we all know, a long time. And so schools are being looked at as maybe a place where we can start doing that kind of measurement. So, you know, I don't have the answers, but... Yes. Yeah, and those are the, I was recently part of a national advisory board that's working with Kaiser Permanente, and it had a lot of the sort of great thinkers in the field, and, you know, not myself, but others that were really talking about these things who've, and they're asking the same questions. How many pieces need to be in place before we know that it's enough to see a change? And we don't know that yet, but we're looking at that. We know the questions, at least. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.